garlic bread, which sounds good, but I got to tell you, from being from back east, I would love to see if they had like scrapple or Taylor pork roll, or maybe just mix it up a little bit, maybe like rack of lamb or mutton chop. I think Lay's really screwed up on that. I mean, there's nothing like mutton chop potato chips with maybe a coleslaw potato chip on the side. So go get your Lay's and say to you, tell them you want mutton chop, because I just had mutton at an Indian restaurant in New Jersey and it was amazing. It was great. So anyway, enough about that. I have a great guest today. I have never met him. I've seen him on TV. I've heard wonderful things about him. Everyone says, oh, this guy's great. And you know, the Paul F. Tompkins, my old friend from Philly, I read somewhere that he was like one of Paul's favorite acts. And I was like, well, then I got to get this guy on the show because Paul loves Jen Kirkman. Jen was on a few weeks ago. And so I have this gentleman. I have Roy Scovel. How you doing, Roy?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate
It's funny. I don't really know much about you. Now, first of all, before we start, last week you had to cancel.
Mm-hmm.
And I see, for me, people, he had three auditions for a pilot. Now, if you don't know what that is, that's like, he must have just pulled. That's like God. I mean, and so, and for me, I didn't care because I'm thinking, if he gets one of these, guess what? Then I could say, hey, Roy Scovel from the show was just like when Brian, do you know Brian Scolaro?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was on talking about before Sullivan and Son came out. So yeah. Now when Sullivan and Son came out, I can post my thing on his page and it gets more hits.
Exactly. Yeah.
But now, so what, how did it go? Were they good? Were you nervous or what was it about?
I feel like when I audition, I'm very nervous. Not being more of a stand-up than anything else. So it is fun to go out, and this is my third year doing sort of pilot auditions, pilot season, I guess, and I feel like I've gotten better at it, so it is more fun now because there's a new kind of confidence in doing it. But yeah, that was a very rare day because I don't ever get three in one day. I don't recommend three in one day. It's too insane trying to, I'll become this person for,
right,
you know, 5 minutes and then this person for 5 minutes. It was, so I think it went okay for the fact that there were three, but I don't know. I enjoy doing it. So when you do get any, it feels good. You never know what, you know, I feel like in this career, you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So.
Now, let me ask you a question about that. When you went on the audition, and there's certain people, you know, there's certain people that have been on the show, talk about auditions, who run into the same people they know.
Yeah.
Like if it's Mark Valley runs into Bill Dwyer and Jamie Kaler, you know, mm-hmm. They have the same kind of look. Do you ever run into some of the same, like, do you sit there and go, wow, I know that guy? Or, I mean, because it's like anything. I don't audition much, but when I do, I always just see it's the bald, you know, glass, you know.
Right.
And certain people, do you see a lot of people? Because you have a different look, because you have the beard and you have your light, your lighter, your blue eyes. Do you see some guys that you run into, or are any of them comics?
Sometimes. I feel like I run into comics all the time. Just because I think they reach out to try to get, you know, comics for certain things, so they definitely want to see what comics do. So I do run into a lot of comics, and I also run into a lot of auditions where everybody there is really good looking, and I feel like I'm the guy they're like, well, let's just see if it looked like him.
There's nothing wrong with that, though.
Right, totally.
Because I get like the creepy looking guy sometimes, and I go in, and I'm sorry, I'm not a bad looking guy, and there's some people who are just, I'm like, wow.
Yeah,
these are my peers.
Yeah, this is my group. This is who I'm paired up with. Yeah.
So how'd they go? Did you feel confident about them? I mean, okay.
I've started to look at them, auditions in general, very similar to stand-up. And like, you know, you go to all these open mics and you start to figure out what it is you're doing and how you like to do it. And then through that process, I think you start to get some confidence. So with acting, with not having a background in it, kind of just learning as I go, much like stand-up, I think they went well. So that's kind of all I aim for. I'm now out of the mental space of being like, oh, I'm going to get this and it's going to change my life. I no longer have this this weird hope about that. I just want to go in and be like, all right, let's just, you know, let's do well. Let's walk out feeling good about what we did. So that day, yeah, for sure. And I had one this morning, and a little different. I walked out going, I don't think that was my best, but you know, like stand up. You know those shows are coming. Those moments are coming.
Right.
So you don't avoid it. You try to walk out and be like, all right, well, was it something I did, or is this just material maybe not for me? Or, you know, it's...
Well, you know what's weird about them, though? A lot of times people, I've heard people say, you know, they went in and thought they just sucked at the audition. And then they get a call back.
Right,
they're like,
yeah.
What the hell? But then sometimes they come out and go, oh, I nailed it. Which I always say when people are like, yeah, I nailed it. It's like
yeah.
It's like comics when they're sitting there, you know, you see it on Facebook. I killed.
Come
on, you did 7 minutes, okay? I've seen you. I used to do a bit on stage going, you couldn't rock the stage if you were 2 feet away from the microphone stand with a boulder. And they all let people get mad at me. I'm like, I don't care. So now, what were some of the roles? I mean, what were some of the roles that you auditioned for?
I'm trying to remember specifically,
like,
last
this morning,
week.
What was it?
This morning it was a older brother character who's a Wall Street slacker who, from reading the pilot and stuff, it was pretty funny, and I think he's just like an off the wall guy. So I think it was a very like high energy thing, and I just got it last night, and I tried to, you know, read the sides today and be prepared. I went in today and I just felt like I wasn't the off the wall guy, and you try to bring that energy, but there's times when you're like, I don't think this is the I can't bring it now, I feel like I don't think I can bring it tomorrow or the next day. You kind of have the sad thing is you have to find out in the moment, much like a joke, you have to find out in the moment if it makes sense or if it works.
And a lot of times people don't know what the hell they want. A lot of these casting people have no idea. I've auditioned for stuff where they're like, do it like that. And I'm like, that doesn't work. And they're saying, you know, it was like a doctor, it was a coach or whatever. And I'm like, that doesn't work. And then I said, let me do it. And they're like, whatever. And I sucked. They hated me. Yeah. And then I see the commercial and it's exactly how I did it. Not me, of course, but it's like, they don't know. And then, and they're not open because a lot of them are young and they're like the assistants. They're like, okay, we'll screen this person.
Yeah. I think I'm just now starting to develop that confidence to bring what I want to do into the room and be like, well, if I were given this opportunity to be this character, this is how I would try to play the character. And I think I've just now sort of realized that's the confidence you have to bring in there, because they, even if they do know what they want, they kind of like for someone to sort of mix it up and show them something new that, you know, maybe they can take from, even if they don't cast you. They might be like, oh, that's a good line he threw out there, let's throw that in, or, you know.
Now, where are you originally from? Are you from South Carolina?
I am. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Because William Connolly, you know, he was on last week, and he said he did some festival with you in South Carolina.
We did. We were at the recent. He's talking about very recent. We were in Charleston.
So.
Yeah,
okay.
The Charleston Comedy Festival, which is fantastic and so much fun to do.
Now, what part are you from in South Carolina?
Greenville. So I'm in the upstate, total opposite of Charleston, direct opposite. And if anyone knows Asheville, it's like 45 minutes south of Asheville.
Now, was it a small town you grew up in, or how did you end up in this path to comedy? Because it's sort of, I always wonder, because a lot of people, like when I started out in the Philadelphia area, Philadelphia's right across the bridge. There's a burgeoning comedy scene. Boston makes sense, but sometimes you hear like, and even Atlanta, but for South Carolina, because it's, I have a friend who moved to Columbia who just loves it, and I heard it's a beautiful. It gets hot down there, but it's a beautiful.
Very
state.
Hot, yeah.
But how did you? I mean, did you? Did you always know you wanted to do stand-up, or what was your path to becoming a comic?
Not at all. I mean, I grew up in a big family, and my aunts and uncles, my dad also comes from a big family in terms of he's one of five kids, I'm one of seven kids. And I think if you come from a big family, well, not this isn't for everybody, for me, coming from a big family where everybody in the family is sort of a smartass and tries to be funny or has that kind of sense of humor, which has been passed down since my grandfather, eventually it gets to you and you start to realize, oh, that's kind of how you get attention and that's how everybody communicates, is by sort of being a smartass or trying to be funny, and everyone seems to gravitate towards it. So I sort of grew up into the vibe of, if you have something funny, you can kind of win everybody over or win everybody's attention. And I think that just bled into, you know, being a class clown at school. Even on my soccer team, I would try to make jokes and stuff. And it just kind of, it's kind of like a branding. It just kind of gets burnt into your mind that's your psyche is, if anything's happening, I try to quickly find what's the funny thing to say, and maybe people will gravitate towards it. And I think that just after college, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I still loved comedy and I kind of wanted to make films. And for some reason, I just one night decided to try stand up. And as you know, from doing it, that one bite that you get, it's enough to, you know, you become addicted. And it was definitely enough for me.
Now, where were you in the pecking order with your family? Were you in the middle, or where were you?
Second oldest of seven.
Okay. So you basically were had like, you know, it was.
I had
that control.
Stage.
You were like the headliner, and you have features and MCs and open micers.
Right. My older sister was more responsible. She was not the class clown at all. So I didn't have much competition upward. So in terms of trying to get everybody's attention and be funny, it was basically me versus much younger siblings, and then, you know, aunts and uncles.
Now, did you watch comedy when you were younger? Mm-hmm. Or did you watch it on TV, or did you get the albums? Or was there any people that you said, wow, you know, I mean.
Yeah, it sort of started off for me, I guess, kind of realizing comedy, like adults doing comedy, was I watched the Marx Brothers and Abbott and Costello, which I don't even know if that's, I was born in 1980, and so I guess I probably started watching that maybe around 6 or 7. My dad kind of turned me on to it.
Okay.
And something about the Marx Brothers specifically, just I feel like 6 or 7 is, even though they're great, they're legendary, and you laugh at them now. For some reason, 6 or 7, it was just ripe for being like, oh, this is the most genius comedy that can ever exist. So I It was kind of something that I was like, oh, I want to do that. And then I got turned on to Monty Python and in high school, and then Mr. Show and Kids in the Hall. And it just kind of felt like this trickle effect of, oh, here are groups of people doing comedy. So that's kind of what I grew up on. And, you know, watching Saturday Night Live, right. In and out of different seasons of Saturday Night Live.
It's always
sure.
weird. It's like, because you watch some of those, and I watch some of the old ones now. And there's some, I mean, there's some really great casts that, I mean, that they're always going to live in the shadow of, you know, Bill Murray and those years, because that was, because back then it was so different. I mean, I was around then, you know, and it was, you were like, wow. I mean, but it's like, for me, it's like, I played Garrett Morris Comedy Club. I posted a picture of Garrett Morris. Some people didn't know who he was.
Right.
And it's like, how do you not know who he is? And so I think they always lived in the shadows, and there was some crappy years.
Yeah.
And then, but then the cast that had Sandler and Schneider and Spade and Farley, so funny.
Yeah.
And even like, I mean, Kristen Wiig was awesome, and just Sandberg, and then, you know, even now Jason Sudeikis. I mean, they're great talents.
I think that Farley age also, when it was sort of that group, that cast, when, you know, Farley was sort of at the peak, that also, I think, was maybe when I was like 14, 15, another like ripe time for like an awesome SNL cast. And also Adam Sandler starting to put out his CDs, sketch CDs, and doing like Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore. I mean, all that stuff was perfect motivation and inspiration to be like, oh, look at how much fun this world looks like. And it was never stand. It didn't occur to me like, oh, stand up is the way to try to get into this. I always wanted to be like a part of a sketch group and be a part of like, you know, four or five people that all had a similar sense of humor, like Monty Python. But it just never happened, you know. And it seemed to be at one point I was like, well, I just got to get on stage, and that maybe that's how I can sort of start getting involved in this.
Now, where'd you go to college at?
University of South Carolina, Spartanburg. Okay. So it's like 30 minutes outside of my hometown.
So you graduated and you want to do this comedy stuff. And how do you find out where to go? Because, I mean, as I said, I don't know if there's a lot of comedy clubs in South Carolina. Is Nag's Head in South Carolina? No, Myrtle Beach is. Wait.
Yeah, Myrtle Beach. Yeah.
And I think there was a Myrtle Beach. I know years ago it was called the Comedy Club. It was Anita and Steve Fletcher who booked Richmond and Williamsburg, and they had that. But I mean, that's not probably near you. But how did you figure out how do you find out? Because there's not a lot of comedy clubs around you.
I'm sure. even my first time on stage was a poetry night. It wasn't even stand up. I just called the bar to ask if I could do stand up, and you know, I brought a bunch of friends, and that was enough to appease the bartender to let me, you know, do whatever I wanted to do.
Did you actually practice formulating an act, or did you know what you're doing? Because it's your first time. I mean, I took a class at the Learning Annex, and it got me to go on stage, and I wrote my act, and I got up, you know, and now, you know, when I do perform, which isn't a lot, I mean, I do every once in a while, but my act's completely different because now I don't care.
Right.
Back then you start off and you really don't know what the hell's going on, and you think everything you write is great.
And you don't know the ingredients, and you don't also, it's like being a cook who doesn't know the ingredients, and you also don't know what you're trying to make anyway, so you couldn't even predict the ingredients. I think if a comedy class had been available to me in that area, I probably would have gone that path, but as it is, I did that open mic poetry night, and it was enough for me to be like, oh man, this is really fun. I didn't really prep anything. I wrote down a bunch of ideas of like, hey, this seems weird, or what if, and I was kind of coming off of David Cross's Shut Up You Fucking Baby, which to me was just brilliant. So I was like, I want to try to, you know, talk that way and do jokes about the way he observed things. That's what I want to do, point out that stuff. So it was kind of me doing an impression of David Cross doing my jokes.
See, a lot of people did it, because I was very Richard Lewis-y on stage at first. But it wasn't me. And then I would just put the mic in the stand and do sort of one-liners, very Stephen Wright style, which is, first of all, it was a pain in the ass because you have to tell so many damn jokes. Even at 7 minutes, you're like, I can't even remember last week. Now I'm like, I tweet jokes all the time. If people go, why don't you use that? I go, because it's just too hard to remember. I said, I'll go up. I mean, it's when I do like a 35-minute set, I'm like, okay, I got to practice a little bit. I go, okay, I got to look at the stuff. But out here when you're doing 8 minutes, I'm like, you know, I'll just go up and I'm thinking, if I think of something, you know.
Right.
And it's weird. And I think a lot of us did that because they were, it's like, and it's not, we weren't stealing their acts. We were tributes. Like, you know, when I was starting out, Dennis Miller was real big. So everyone thought, okay, we're going to write that Dennis Miller, you know, thesaurus plus a hip reference.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And then you find out, well, no, because that's his style. And you look like an idiot because you don't look hip like him.
It's so weird how that doesn't occur to you right away either. Because I think your mindset is just, you see these people having fun.
Right.
Doing it, and you just want to sort of co-op that fun. You're like, I want to, like, even when I saw Nick Swardson's first half-hour special, it was that same thing where I was like, man, it just looks like what he's doing is a fun thing to do.
Right.
I want to have that fun, and I think that leads you to just naturally think, well, oh, I'll talk the way this person talks, because that seems to be where the fun is. And then it really starts to occur, like, oh, there's a lot of fun if you get away right. from that and you generate it on your own completely. And then that's such a rewarding experience when you finally, that snap
right.
happens.
And, that's a weird thing also for your generation is, look at me, I'm so old, your generation, back when I was in there, we didn't know about mics. But no, for your
generation. We didn't have microphones. You just go way back.
We had megaphones. We go, hey, we had a Mr. Microphone. That's like the hack joke of every comic back in the late 80s, early 90s. They go on stage if the sound system sucks. Hey, I'm using a Mr. Microphone. Hey, babes, be back to pick you up in a minute. And after a while, you're like, shut up.
Yeah,
you know. And now people are still doing it. And you go, people don't know what a Mr. Microphone is.
Yeah.
Okay? It's like my Fender sound system. So now, well, I just lost my train of thought. Oh, I think for your generation, and the difference also was for, you know, there's so much comedy on TV. Like for us when we started, there was The Tonight Show. And then you got A&E, which really sort of killed comedy, but there was always on. But they'd say if you had a good 7 minutes, you can get on there.
Yeah.
But for you, you could actually see and know what's going on, because you wouldn't know who comics were, you know, unless you were in the road. There wasn't the internet. So you'd play in a club on the road and you see this headline and you go, oh, I wonder, and you couldn't find clips.
Or albums, if you came across
right.
albums, yeah, for sure.
So for you, it's probably useful a lot. Now, after you do the open mic, poetry, which is cool, that's, you know, it's a stage, which is
yeah,
good,
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And now they do that a lot of places. Now, after you do that, you have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
So now where do you set your paths? What do you say, I want to do this now?
Well,
what was your major in?
Communications, okay. journalism. With okay. the focus in journalism. I took it specifically because there were like film classes in it. I mean, I really did want, and I still do want to make films, but at that time I was like, you know, I want to be a filmmaker, but I just don't know how you do that. And I
right.
didn't understand what it was. So I was like, you know, well, maybe I can at least learn, you know, how to make, you know, something 7 minutes or, you know, like everybody, you know, tries to do. But yeah, after graduating, I was like, I don't know what to do and I don't know how to do it. And then when I found this, it was it sort of started to write itself out, like how to do it. Like my sister lived in Washington, D.C. I went to visit her that New Year's after I had performed at that poetry night.
All right.
And I thought to my and while I was there, I went through the city paper. I saw that there were like tons of open mics, and I just called a place and I said, "Can I come and perform?" And they said, "Yeah, if you can be here at this time, you can go on." So me and my sister and all her friends in D.C. that she could gather, who were like, oh, this is crazy, someone's going to do stand-up. We all went to this hotel bar, and I jumped on stage, and I did 7 minutes, and it definitely wasn't the same.
Okay.
But it was enough for me to be like, oh, I'm now watching other people go up and do 7 minutes. So I'm seeing what this looks like, and I saw the city paper. I saw how many times a week does this event happen all over the place, and it just dawned on me, you know, my sister already lives here. I can crash on her couch. She'll help me out, and so that's what I did.
Was it a comedy club or just a bar?
It was like a Best Western hotel, and it was a bar in the basement. There was no, I think the comics were grateful to put me up because me and my sister must have brought 15 people.
See, there
so,
you go.
And the show was already going. So anybody who was like, you know, one, two, or three missed out. And then
right.
I brought in 15 people. So when I asked if I could go up, they were, you know, every comic as you would be, where there's no crowd, you're like, well, yeah, sure, do five. And that's all I wanted was five. I didn't even know what to do. So yeah, go do five, and then we can all benefit from the people you brought. So it worked out well, also because I'm in another position where I know the audience. Like, I brought a lot of people the first time. I brought a lot of people the second time. So it was motivation to be like, oh, I can be silly and do what I wanted to do. And it was really fun. Yeah, it was fun to do, and it was enough for me to be like, I want to be here doing this more. I want to, whatever this is. And I think a lot of people that just start doing stand-up, you can see how hungry they are to be like, I want to drop everything, and I want to soak up all of that. I want to soak up the social scene
right.
of this. I want to know where the shows are. I want to go on stage. I want to figure out, well, what do you do when you want to start doing 15 minutes or 20 minutes? How does that all work? What does it look like? And I got that bug the same way we all do.
So you're living in South Carolina, but you're staying with your sister.
I was living in South Carolina. I went up for that one New Year's. I moved back, and then I went back after that visit, and then I decided, you know, in February I'm buying a ticket and I'm moving up there, and that's just what I'm going to do.
And now, so you start hitting all the open mics. Now,
yeah.
How many nights were you getting on stage?
Early on, I waited about a month. I signed up. I went to every open mic I called every place in the city paper to see if they had an open mic, because some places were still listed that they were like, we haven't done a show in years.
Right.
Like, well, you're still in the paper.
They're so relevant. those papers. Right. It's like Community Watch. It was this week in Burbank. It's like that bar was closed 4 years ago.
Yeah, it's fire. It was a fire 4 years ago. I went to every single one that was listed and actually had a show. And even at those shows, I would ask the comics where the other shows were. And at every one, I went to the person running it and asked if I could perform. And it was sort of a sign up. And they were like, well, the wait right now is a month. You know, if you want to come back in 3 weeks, come back. So for a month, I went to all those shows each week because, like I said, you know, you become so obsessed. And to me, it was like so fun. It's like you discover this underground thing that isn't underground, but it sort of is.
It is. I think it's just like in Philly, you know, there was a Comedy Factory outlet in the Comedy Works, and the open night was one night. And, you know, each club had their people. Like, I was more of an outlet person, like me and a guy named Steve Thomas and Keith Robinson. Mm-hmm. And, like, Paul F. Tompkins was more of a works guy. And then Adam McKay was back and forth, you know, but he was like, we all would get jobs at the door getting paid $5 an hour under the table.
Yeah.
But that meant on the open mic, when there's usually 25 nights, you'd have to pick out a hat. You got slotted like between 4 and, you know, 14, and you were getting slotted, and the other people got slotted where acts would come in. Like, as you started working, you'd go in and you would get slotted and you would get 8 minutes instead of 5.
Right.
And it was a whole like a different community. And for us, it was even more hardcore, because back then it wasn't, you know, there weren't actors who wanted to do stand-up. And I've said this in the show many times, that back then, if you were a guy who wanted to do stand-up just to get a pilot, we'd, like, shun you. It's like, you might as well just, like, walk. You might as well be, you know, it was like we were, like, bullied. Not
but
bullied.
Also, it was probably kind of rare, too,
yeah,
right?
It wasn't. And then people were like, oh, I'm doing this. And it's like, no. And then you're like, no, we're comics, you know?
Yeah.
It was that underground. And you go to the South Street Diner. You'd hang out, after, especially when you started working. There's all those clubs during the boom with, like, 20 minutes. And so the diner would have, you'd have, like, 4 tables of comics just going, and it was a clique. I mean,
it was a clique. It was a gang. It was like this whole other,
it was a counterculture. It was different. I mean, it was.
And the thing about it is, you didn't know how much you loved it until that was gone. I've said that to other comics, that even when I first started in DC, someone had said to me, you know, never, you know, you're in that first 3 years, you know, soak up that first 3 years. And that just doesn't make any sense to anybody till that fourth year. And then you go, oh, this is, things are starting to happen. That 3 years is gone now. That playground isn't the same. Everybody, it doesn't occur to you that at year 4, 5, 6, maybe even further, but everyone is just going to go separate directions, because it then occurs to you, oh yeah, this is an individual pursuit. Whether we're all trying to do it together or not, we're not a team.
Right.
We're just a family, you know?
And I think it's funny, because I think with LA, I mean, because I'll stop by like Flappers because it's right in my neighborhood.
Mm.
And, you know, I got to know some of the younger comics. And, you know, I mean, it's the old thing, you know, every comic, you know, they're who's this? And of course, as I get out of the business, but I still know what to do. I did over 2,500 professional shows. I mean, I was on the road from 88 to 95. So when you go on stage, it comes back to you. Then I have a really good set, and they're like, oh, wait a second, you know, and it's like, and you talk to them. But I think out here, you don't have that. Like, I think DC, I know DC had some comics, you know, and like the Fat Doctor was big back there. And there's Kevin James, I think. Not Kevin James, Kevin something. He was an African American who juggled and, I don't know, but there's certain people you had, and then there was like, you know, and out of DC there was like the guys from Baltimore go down there, like Patton Oswalt and Blaine, and there's a guy named Chris Paul, not the basketball player.
Patton and Blaine are probably two big motivations for a lot of guys like myself, you know, when in DC. Like, I didn't know who Patton was when I started doing stand-up. I feel like you kind of don't know who a lot of people are, unless they're mega famous. Like, if you're at Seinfeld, you're like, oh, yeah, everyone knows Seinfeld.
Right.
But a lot of people that are about to be big, you kind of don't know till you get into stand-up. And knowing that Patton, you know, had sort of come from that area.
Yeah, because they were Baltimore guys, and then Baltimore guys would go to D.C. It's like us Philly guys would go to Baltimore. So
yeah,
transgression.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say was, I think there was that crowd out here. I don't think there's that community. I think, and honestly, this isn't me, you know, I just think a lot of these younger comics are pricks. I mean, they're newer, and they think they know everything, and they have attitude, and it's like, no. You know what? There's no camaraderie, because everyone's trying to backstab each other to get a spot at the store, and it's like, and they think, you know, right away they're ready. But then it was true. It was like you in DC, and that's in Philly, and I'm sure the Boston. I've heard the Boston guys, and even the New York guys, the people that are older than me who were in the beginning, they had like this, you know, there's competitiveness between you, and you'd be pissed if someone got a gig, but it was like a brotherhood, it was a fraternity.
Absolutely, yeah. I think. That's something I definitely miss, because and it occurred to me, you know, like, it's not something you can recreate, because it's guys that you are jumping into a black hole with, that you don't know what you're trying to do. I think out here, I think I see do see some camaraderie, but I don't think it's the same in terms of what we're talking about, just because out here you can see a light at the end of the tunnel, whereas in D.C., you don't think TV show or movie, because you think in your head, not in a million years, I'll never be, I just, all I know is to do 10, and all I care about is if that first 30 seconds is going to work. And I think that's what, even though I am trying to sort of figure out how to transition into this world of learning acting, I do go back going, you know, I'm really happy that I started in D.C. and then moved to New York, because to me that really showed me what it means to be a stand-up comic. I still don't think I maybe got that full lesson. I feel like maybe I should have stayed in New York for maybe even 5 more years to really soak it up. But I know what you mean in terms of that sort of group, that brotherhood. Yeah. You know?
It's true. It's like, I mean, it is, you know, you see it on Facebook, which Facebook is the killer of comedy, because everyone posts their shows. Everyone, I did this, and it's like people who put a comedian in front of their name who have never been paid to do a gig. You're not a comedian.
Yeah.
It's like I say, people go, oh, I'm going on the road to San Diego. Then you're driving for 2 hours to do a show, to do 7 minutes. You're not getting paid. By the time the night's over, you spent $25 in gas.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it's just, it's different. I think because Facebook, everyone, and there's so many comics now. Like back, like that's what's great about DC or Philly. I just read an article, and Todd Glass was actually on the cover, this little inside of the Philadelphia. I was just back seeing my girlfriend last weekend. The Philadelphia Inquirer. They had the comedy, you know, the revival of comedy in Philly. Now it's more improv, but comedy's coming back. And I think that's the thing here. There's so many comics, and the philosophy here is, you know, back there was open mics, and you go and you get on stage.
Yeah.
And then you got paid work, and you know, you got opening and feature and headliner. But out here, it's like anyone can get a stage time if they can bring people.
Yeah.
Even if they suck. And I think back then, people sucked in Philly. When we started out, we didn't suck, but we didn't know anything. People would take you under their arm. You know, I had a guy, George Sharp, who basically mentored me. And he's like, no, you don't have to be nervous. And it was a great feeling. I don't see that happen out here as much.
I think I'm starting to see a little bit more in terms of like the independent shows that comics run at, like, you know, coffee shops or bars or even theaters. I feel like I'm seeing it more and more of like younger comics, you know, men and women who are moving out here. And it is kind of because I don't know if you see it a lot at the clubs, because I pop into the Laugh Factory or the Improv every now and then. I'd say very rarely. I try to do mostly the independent rooms. Okay. But going to those clubs, I know what you're talking about. There does seem to see that lack of family, but I also maybe think, for me, I perceive it that way just because I'm there so rarely, where I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'm committing enough of my own efforts or energy to be here to actually know what the family is, because I have so many comics who talk about the different places they go to, the store or the factory, and saying how much they enjoy it. And I'm like, yeah, I guess the experience is different for everybody, how much you put into it. But I think on the independent scene, and I hate calling it that, but I don't really know what else it would be. A lot of people are like, oh, it's the alt scene. But yes, there's alternative comics, but in the alt scene, in terms of a show, it's really just alternative to not being a stand-up club, I guess. But doing those independent shows, I do see some people who's kind of losing my train of thought, but I do see some people whose goal, it maybe doesn't seem, because it's out here, who's maybe they don't want to get on the road. They are here to be like, well, you know, a lot of the comics I looked up to, they kind of came out of LA and they're here, so I'm gonna sort of be here where they started, and I don't really want to go on the road. I do want to go to auditions and do this and that. And I think that's what makes the LA scene very unique to all other scenes, is that here there's another job that you can get via stand-up. Now, that makes some people horrible stand-ups. It also makes some people fall in love with stand-up that never would have wanted to do stand-up.
That's true. And
stand-up.
And that's the thing also about LA, is that for me, I mean, I get... It's so much easier for me to get great guests to come in studio than it is for someone, even in New York. I mean, it's like my friend Joe. Do you know Joe Matarese?
Yes, yeah.
Well, me and Joe went to the same high school. And even...
This is Joe.
Even even then, he's like, and he lives in New York, and he's an established comic. It's hard for me to get guests sometimes, because there's not, you know, and that's the one good thing about LA, is I can sit there and just pop off an email. Like, I sent you a message on Facebook.
Yeah.
I do that all the time. Sometimes people don't respond.
Yeah.
I got upset, but in the beginning, I was like, yeah, but then a lot of people, like, you know, like younger acts like yourself or like Ben Glebe. You know, Ben was on, because I sent him and he saw my guest list. I said, you know, Paul Provenza, and he's like, wow. And I met Renan, and he goes, that, I had to do it. And that's the thing. I can get acts like that, where a lot of places you can't. And that's the thing that sucks. I mean, it's like, you know, you could be a guy who's in Connecticut who just loves comedy and would die to have these guests. And that's the thing. Everything's accessible out here, I think, also.
I think that's what I like from my own perspective. That's one thing I loved about New York is that New Yorkers are very hard-edged education on how to work with audiences that don't necessarily care to hear what you're saying, and then you can go perform at, you know, maybe a hipper room. They always say, like, a hipster room. I mean, if you play in Williamsburg, yeah, there's a good chance there's a lot of hipsters there,
right.
But it runs you through the mill of, here are every genre of person you can imagine that you can run one joke by to see what everyone thinks of it. And I think that's really cool. But for me personally, I like being out here because when I am on these shows and these bigger names that, you know, some that a lot of people I've looked up to for a long time, some people I respect, some people that are huge names that I could care less about.
Right.
It's fun to almost get to do that as an audience member with them to see, like, well, what is their process? I've seen this person become uber famous, and now I get to be here to watch them work out 7 minutes. It's
right.
Like some shows, you know, Louis C.K. will pop into the smallest of shows in New York City. And as a comic, it's kind of a rare treat to get to watch someone not crush who you know will crush
right.
with the thing that's not crushing right now. And I think what is cool about L.A. is you do get to see that from some people who you're probably disinterested in seeing. But there are some comics who pop in where you're like, oh, you're a huge inspiration.
Right.
Here I am getting to be 3 feet away from you, whereas if I were somewhere else, I might not get that, you know?
Now, you talk about New York a lot. Now you're in D.C., and you're hitting all the open mics. Now, when did you start making the transition to New York? How long were you in D.C. doing comedy before you said, I'm moving to New York?
3.5 years, I think, I was there. And I felt like I was starting to get up on all the shows, and I felt like I knew everybody in the community. And for me, it felt like, all right, I'm starting to see, you know, how big this community can get, and I'm starting to see what you can get from it. And at that time, it felt like, all right, it's time to get, you know, start over education. You know?
Now, were you graduated past open mics in New York? I mean, in D.C., were you doing weekend clubs? I don't know. I'm probably garbage.
Well, you
wasn't around anymore.
It's so weird to me because in D.C., all the shows were, you know, you got booked for them, even though it was like an open mic. It just wasn't sign-up stuff. So it was always, it felt like every show was just a showcase show that you were booked for. Like actually showing up to a place and signing your name down wasn't, it might be now, but it wasn't at the time like a D.C. thing. Like you showed up knowing that you were on the show. You were one of 10 people on the show, or, you know, if you showed up and they were nice enough to throw you on, that was your best bet. But it wasn't until I moved to New York and started traveling, going on the road and seeing sort of the local nights at a lot of clubs on the road, I was like, oh, there's a whole different system everywhere where you show up and you sign up. I don't think I would have necessarily been someone who had graduated past the sign up thing if that were a thing.
Okay.
I think I just was at a point where I knew everybody, and it seemed like a lot of shows were starting to go well. I was starting to gain a consistency, and I think my fear of it was getting addicted to the fact that I wasn't the best in D.C., but I think I was, you know, had become popular enough. And I think my fear was getting used to that popularity and wanting it and then being like, oh, I never moved. I never threw myself into a giant pond to get thrown back to the bottom of the totem pole to have to then try to get back up it. And I think that can be a bad move for a lot of people to not move at the right time. And if you soak in that jacuzzi too long, you're not going to get out. You're
right,
going to stay.
Yeah. Now, so you moved to New York. Now, did you have friends up there, comics up there you knew? Or where do you go? Because you're a D.C. comic, and 3 years isn't even that long in the business.
Right.
And it's smart you waited. Because I know some people move to New York who just aren't ready. And it's like they always say you spend at least 2 or 3 years in your town. I mean, because it's invaluable, and you do get the camaraderie. And you
the
get
amount
the
of stage time is just it is everything. 3 years, you know, 3 years minimum. You know,
right.
Stay in that town and get up as often as possible. Because as soon as I went to New York, that is when I started really figuring out, not mastering it, but figuring out how it worked to try to get booked on the road. I was like, oh, okay, it really is knowing comics from everywhere, because that's who puts in the good word for you. So that's when I started, you know, trying to utilize Facebook and finding people and finding shows and trying to get on the road. But in New York specifically, I was not getting up a lot at all. I mean, I went a whole year with very little stage time, and that's when it occurred to me, like, oh, this is the starting over process, to the point where if you don't get on, I mean, the road saved me. It kept me.
Well, where were you going on the road? What were some of the towns? I mean, were they weekend gigs or what was the?
It'd be weekend stuff. I would go back to, I did the Seattle Comedy Competition right before I moved to New York.
Okay.
So that helped me meet a lot of comics who came from everywhere to do that competition. So I got to network with them. And then also Seattle specifically, I got to know a lot of those comics, and to me, the Pacific Northwest has a ton of one-nighters and like weekend
triple
gigs.
Triple run.
I mean, that kind of stuff is everywhere. And even in Canada, I had already done some stuff in Canada, so I just decided to utilize it. I was like, I'm going to try to get in with a club and see if I can go back, you know, every 6 months, because I was just middling. You know, there wasn't going to be a pressure to have a whole new thing if I'm just doing, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. So I would try to do that with every single club, and then any one-nighter I could get. I would go away from New York for 2-3 months at a time and just stay gone, trying to do whatever I could to not have to buy flights. You know, if comics knew of shows, I would go and just do a week of open mics in Seattle and then try to do a weekend gig in go up to Vancouver and do a weekend there and kind of bounce around. And I really loved it, doing not getting stage time in New York and needing money and really pushing myself to do that road stuff was really the education that is why I'm still doing stand-up today. Okay. And in my own opinion, like, doing it better than I was then, like, growing because of those experiences, for sure.
So now you're doing these road gigs, and then when after the 2 months, you come back to New York, and you're not getting stage time. Mm-hmm. At what point does New York change for you?
It took about a year, I think. After a year, a few more people had moved there who were definitely more aggressive at going out to shows. So sort of through them, I got to meet a lot more people.
Who were some of those comics?
It was actually guys from Seattle. Scott Moran, David Cope, Andy Haynes. All these people had moved and were very hungry to go out and get to know everybody in New York. And so I started going out with them and getting to know those people. And any friends that, you know, used to live in New York who were coming out to visit, who I'd met on the road, would call me up and I'd go out with them and meet people. And it just slowly became this, every time I get on stage, I've got to do A stuff. I've got to show people that I know what I'm doing. And it took a while of doing that. And I think after enough times because every comic, when you see, even if someone's a total asshole off stage, when you see someone who's good on stage, I feel like you can't deny it. You say, hey, that person's a jerk, but I'll tell you what, they do 7, they crush, and you do start, your name just starts to get around. Not that I was going up and crushing, but I think I was doing well enough where people were like, oh, here's this guy, you know? So maybe, hey, do you want to do my show? And it became, you know, you do one show and there's 7 comics watching, maybe 3 of them have a show, and they every week they need 8 people. So I think the volume of shows in New York, anybody running a show, if you see anybody who does even okay, you start saying, hey, come and do my show, come and do this, come and do that, and you just start getting up more and more. And after about a year and a half, that started happening. At a year and a half, I was like, wow, I'm starting to see what it's like. When people say you can get up a lot, it really is starting to happen now.
Now, during that time, you know, you're still going back on the road now. Did you get any TV work then?
The one thing I had, I did Live at Gotham on Comedy Central right before I moved to New York. So I went into New York with that. It hadn't aired.
You had done it from D.C.
I taped it. I think we taped Live at Gotham the weekend that I moved up to New York.
Now, how did you get that?
When I did that Seattle comedy competition, the Comedy Central people were there at the very first night of that competition. I did really well, and they said, hey, we want you to audition. And I was like, hey, when I go back to D.C., you guys are already coming to the Improv to see me and all my friends. I'm already on the audition. And Bart Coleman actually said, well, at that audition, do exactly what you did tonight. So now I was like, oh, that's the greatest gift you could give me. I don't have to worry about it. I will do that exact 5. I will do it the exact same way. And I did that. But I was also coming off 3 months of being away. I did a month and a half in Canada. Then I did that Seattle comedy competition. So I was gone for another month. So I was gone 2.5 months when I did that audition. And I just felt, I was performing every night for 2.5 months. So when I got up and someone said, do 6 minutes, it was like, I don't have to look at anything. I feel it. I can just do it. And that's amazing how that comes and goes. Like when you are getting up all the time, as you know, when you're doing it all the time, you just become a Jedi. And then if you stop for 2 weeks, you're like, I got to start over. It's gone. It's gone. The power's gone.
No. So you had Gotham. So now you're in New York. You're going on the road. Now, at what point do you decide to leave New York? And why? Was there a certain reason or what? And did you know people in L.A. or what had happened?
Sort of. I did Just for Laughs, and I got I already had a manager and I had an agent.
Now, how long were you in New York?
I think 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now, but were you becoming a regular at the comic strip or those places?
I never really did a lot of clubs in New York. I think I'm bred that way because in D.C. there was just the D.C. Improv. And as someone starting out, you basically got MC work there. I think I worked there maybe once a year in my first 3 years.
Okay.
I worked there more now, but as an MC, I only work there once every 3 years. So I was already in this mindset of, if you want stage time, you go to the coffee shops, you go to the backs of bars, you go to these places. So even in New York, I didn't want to hang out at the clubs and put in the time. I would do Caroline's. Towards the end of my stay in New York, Caroline's became very inviting, putting me up a lot, as did Comics, which is now gone, was also the same way. But I didn't really go around to a lot of the clubs. My biggest regret is not trying harder to see if I could get an audition at the Comedy Cellar to become a regular there, or at least someone that maybe they threw on once a week. I just never had the confidence to feel like I was at that level. I mean, you saw guys like Todd Barry and Bill Burr and David Tell going in there, and to me, those guys are invincible. So when you think about, oh, I want to get on the stage with those guys, in my head you're like, that's their playground. Those guys are the kings of doing this job. So I think that's my one regret of clubs. I didn't, you know, make a better effort at trying to sort of get in and meet those people.
So you're doing the underground. So what is it with LA? Do you sit there and go, I have to do this to change my career? I mean, did you have different avenues, or you said you had management?
I had management, and then after doing Just for Laughs, I got an agent, and you know, they explained to me, you know, you start going out for audition. As I did a little bit in New York, I started going out for different things because I am very interested in acting. I do want to act. Okay. I do want to write, and I still do want to make films, as well as, you know, now this obsession that I don't see it ending with stand-up. So it's like, all right, well, I can still do stand-up in L.A., but I can now start the process of trying to figure out, well, what is acting? How does this business... I'm one of those people that there is something awful about the amount of rejection that comes with L.A., with auditions and doing and being out here. But having stand-up as my main thing that I love, that rejection doesn't hurt as much as bombing one show. I mean, if I didn't get 100 auditions, I just want to make sure I'm still good going on stage. Like, that's my main thing. So I want to learn the entertainment industry. I want to know how it works as a business. I want to know what everybody does. I want to know why certain films get made over ones that might have been better, and how does the money work. So I think wanting to have that education, I just said, you know what, I think I have to be in LA get that.
Now, when you moved out, how did you find a place? What was your poll process there? Did you know people? I mean, because some people, I mean, I found when me and my ex-wife lived in San Diego, but I was coming up here trying to get stuff going. And luckily, I knew a guy who moved, and I found this little studio. It was like $385 behind. It was at the time Sunset and Highland wasn't the best area.
Yeah, right.
But now the same thing's probably 1,000. But I knew someone, because I had no idea about LA. And I never, and it's funny, I think a lot of people who are not from the area, we think LA is this big scary city, and when you get up here, it's like it's a bunch of suburbs.
Even
like Burbank. Hey, you go down Burbank, not Magnolia, there's like a rubber stamp store. It's like Mayberry.
Right. And it's a bunch of different cities.
Right.
Right. All in one city.
So how did you pick where to live, or what was your process?
I did know people out here, and I had stayed on people's couches plenty of times.
Okay.
I did one pilot season out here when I didn't know. And in my very first pilot season, I just crashed on a friend's couch, and I was like, I got to be here. They're getting me auditions. And they were very kind enough to let me sleep on the couch. So when me and my now fiance, when we decided to move out here, we stayed with friends and we had a car, and we decided to just drive every day looking for rent signs in neighborhoods that we, you know, people had recommended to us. I knew that I wanted to live on the east side. I had walked around with Brendan Walsh one day. We had walked all through Silver Lake, and he was like, you should live in Silver Lake. And I was like, I want to be in, you know, West Hollywood, be closer to all the clubs and stuff. And he was like, at the end of the day, you're going to want to be on the east side. Trust me. We walked around one day, and I was like, I get it. I see what you're saying. It's quieter. It's more neighborhood.
Yeah, that's like me. It's like me and my ex-wife had lived also when we were up here for a little bit. I'd been in Hollywood, then we lived in Westwood.
Yeah.
Too much traffic. You know, I love Burbank because it's quiet.
Yeah.
You know, it's you can get everywhere pretty quick.
Yeah.
There's always going to be traffic in L.A.
Yeah, it doesn't go away. So
you move out here. So now what's your path now? What's your game plan?
You know, I
now you had management,
right?
You had one TV appearance.
Yeah,
you had somewhat of a name. People knew you.
What's funny is that when I sort of bookended New York, and it was no plan. It just worked out this way. When I moved there, I just did Live at Gotham, and when I left, I did Fallon. So it was like this weird.
Oh, you did do Fallon.
My two TV things had fallen right as I had come and gone from New York.
Now, how many times did you audition for Fallon?
Fallon,
did they know you?
I think we had sent a tape in, like a set, maybe an seven, eight minute set. And then we worked on the set, and I kind of lost touch and then reconnected about trying to get it. It took about a year, I think, till actually a date came up, and it seemed like they were happy with a very specific set. And in that year, I probably could have been a little more proactive about trying to sharpen the set. But, you know, I think every all previous years, you know, you're a little more stubborn about your craft and your art, and you really are like, no, this is how I do it, and this is how I say it. And then when you finally go do a thing, you're like, oh, I see. You didn't really want me to kill what I do. I just needed to rework it, and I was being stubborn. Now, sometimes that stubbornness is valid, and some people want you to change things too much. But I think over the course of that year, I was just kind of like, ah, no, I sent in two tapes. They don't like it. They don't like it. And then someone was like, what are you talking about? You're trying to get on national TV. And then it occurred to me, like, oh, yeah, you know, maybe I can probably not do that joke and not whine about it.
So you move out here and you already have those two credits, okay? And now you start hitting the coffee houses again or the alt scene? I mean,
now I had no, because I had popped out here enough times before moving, I now knew people. I now knew comics. My manager was also able to sort of email to get me stage time at places. And then it was kind of, it wasn't as bad as starting over in New York because I was still so new. It was like starting over a little bit, but I now felt more confident about who I was, and I felt more confident that other comics maybe knew who I was. Not everybody, but like enough to where I felt like a part of the community. So after moving out here, I just kind of shadowed a bunch of comics, going to shows, trying to meet people, seeing what's going on, and getting up and performing way sooner than that year and a half waiting in New York. I definitely did the homework. Learning from that New York experience, I definitely did the homework to be like, all right, I need to know people before I get out there. And so I basically moved out here and just immediately started, you know, asking questions with my management and you know, how does it work with, you know, auditions? And I feel like it's just something you start to learn. You just start to see, like, all right, pilot season. All right, pitch season. All right, guest stars, mid-season things. All right, movies, they're all the time. But, you know, you got to have generals and these casting directors got to get to meet you. And after being out here now over 2 years, it every day I feel like it starts to make a little bit more sense, whether I like it or not, how it all works. I start to see, like, you know, it when people say it's all who you know, like, that really is the for every single job, I think, in this country.
Oh, yeah.
That applies to everything.
I ended up doing this because I always wanted to do radio. I know how to do it. And I was doing corporate marketing for a restaurant. I got laid off. I met the guy who does this show here. Mm-hmm. And I met him at a Chamber of Commerce mixer. And I was like, yeah, Cooper will be good. Well, a year later, down the road, and then it's just true. It's who you know.
Yeah.
So now you're here for, you've been here for 2 years. So mm-hmm. you get out here. Now, you've done Conan.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a bunch of shows.
I did Conan twice with my buddy John Doerr. Okay. We did like a two-man thing. And I did Conan just like a spot, like a late-night spot as myself. And then I did a half-hour thing on Comedy Central. And
now, how did that all happen? Because as you said, you weren't hanging out at the Comedy Store. You weren't hanging out at the Improv. You weren't hanging out at the Laugh Factory. And everyone says, oh, you have to be there to do it. How did those all come about if you weren't hanging there?
Yeah, to me, I don't think, and this is what I think has been the evolution of sort of evolving a career, like we were saying before. You know, you didn't have the internet where you could go on YouTube and learn about comics or even expose yourself, you know, get yourself out there, your name out there. So I think now you don't necessarily have to put in the same time at all the comedy clubs the way that you used to. I think now when you do the independent rooms, there's enough of a social circuit, enough of a word of mouth about people who might be doing well. Granted, I had done Live at Gotham, so now I'm on Comedy Central's radar, you know, which can one day, you know, and also your management constantly barking in their ear saying, hey, you should see Rory. I think it just came about from putting a tape together 1 year and submitting it and getting rejected, and then trying to get it again the next year and getting rejected, and then being like, all right, I see that this process is either they don't think I'm ready, or maybe I'm not ready, or I think I am ready. But the year that I actually did get like the half hour special, I put out a CD, and I think my manager sent that CD as opposed to something visual. Or not the CD, she sent the flip, recorded flip footage of me doing my CD to Comedy Central. And I think that was sort of a merging of them knowing me long enough and them seeing me maybe mature as a performer to go, oh, this seems like a year that we could bring him in where he can do 30, and we like the 30 that he'll want to do, kind of thing. I really, truly don't know how any of it, how the attention comes or how you get anything, because I don't think I necessarily network in terms of schmoozing. I think my whole philosophy and my only outlook is that the only thing I can control and do and love is to make sure I have fun every single time I go on stage. And to me, that's what attracts the attention of the people maybe that you need to know that want to speak up for me. Even you saying that you had read, you know, even Paul F. Tompkins saying anything about me, that, you know, that comes from him seeing something on stage that he liked as opposed to a handshake and just, hey, I do this and I do that. It's like, no, once I see you, if there's something there, you then start to speak up and say people's names, as we all do. I've said other people's names to people that, you know, they needed the attention as well. I think that's been my only philosophy. My only outlook is like, well, if I just have fun every time I'm performing, I think that's infectious enough.
Right. I think so. So now you're on TV a bunch of shows, you know, you did Conan and mm-hmm. you've done Fallon before and the Comedy Central. Now at this point, are people not comics, but are people recognizing you? Do they sit there and they go, oh, because I think anything, you remember comics. And it's so funny because I'll be out at bars, which I love to do, and I'll be talking to people and they know I do comedy or radio and they'll be like, oh, have you ever had this guy on? And I'm like, no, it's because people seem to be people now know more, like people that you would think would never know this comic. They go, hey, have you ever had this guy on? And I'm like, no, or have you had this guy on? Yeah, you know, and so people start recognizing you, or did you get, I mean, how did it happen?
I think that the community of comedy support is now very similar to people, the same way they maybe like indie bands and indie music. Like music is so accessible now that I think naturally comedy has kind of trickled into that, where people know of comics and people now know comics that no one's heard of. Like, it's sort of fun to know no-name comics who maybe one day will be big. And I think that's where the term comedy nerd has kind of come from, these people that really obsess over over comedians. But I'm not anyone who, when I walk into a place that anyone recognizes or, hey, I've seen you on this. I do know that because of doing like podcasts like this or stuff with Todd Glass or Doug Benson, that at my shows on the road, I do now have some people that come out to the show who say, hey, I've heard you on a great reason why podcasts have been fantastic. Because also when someone comes up to you at a show and says, hey, I listened to you on, you know, Steve's show or Todd's show, you then go, oh, good, because you're probably you're probably exactly who I want here.
Yes.
That's probably why tonight was fun, because a lot of you are huge Todd Glass fans who go, oh, we're so obsessed with Todd Glass that if he has someone on the show who we like, and that person's in our town, we're like, well, of course we'll go. It's like sort of a 6 degrees of separation. And so it's never any like, hey, I saw you out and I recognize you, or I found you. A lot of times, or no, it is I found you. It is like, hey, I found you through a podcast, or I saw you, your half hour special. It's not overwhelming. It's not where I'd like it to be. I would love it. I mean, this is everyone's dream. I'd love it if I could go to a club in my next place is the Comedy Attic in Bloomington, Indiana. I would love it if when I showed up, everyone there is like, yeah, we don't necessarily know your stand-up, but we've heard of you, so we kind of know what we're in for.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, well, this is the perfect setting for a show.
Now, do you go on the road a lot now? Because you said you were doing it, and then you're out here, and because of pilot season, of course, you probably don't go out.
Right.
I think maybe your schedule changes. It's like Craig Fitzsimmons will go out on certain, like twice a month, because he has a family, and he'll go like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and he'll get Craig Fitzsimmons money.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but that's enough for him. But then he has the writing things. Now, do you find yourself, well, probably during pilot season, you don't go out much, but how many weeks now are you on the road?
I'd say it's a lot. In a month, it can change. I will go out anytime. Now that I have an agent who does that booking stuff, I will say yes probably almost every single time, unless it's a club I just don't enjoy, or the money isn't good, or if it conflicts with something. But I try to go out 2 to 3, sometimes 4 weekends out of a month, because I'm still obsessed. I mean, from 2006, when I quit my job and I went and I did that Canadian tour and the competition, it just got in my head like, oh, you know, this is the job. You got to call these clubs. You got to get in touch. You got to map out your weekends throughout the year, because you got to figure out the money that's going to be your income. And even now, having an agent who, you know, the stuff is sort of filtered through him, I'm still obsessed with making sure I'm going out enough. I feel like in a way it's an obsession and a sickness, but it's also a reality that this is the job. But just because the job is fun doesn't mean you get to necessarily decide when the job is. Now, granted, you get to a certain point with other responsibilities. I'm someone who doesn't have kids or anything, so I'm maybe in a different position. But yeah, I try to go out as often as possible throughout the year, because there's also that fear of, like we were saying with that Jedi thing, there's that fear of going, oh, I'm going to forget everything.
Now, do you still enjoy the road? I mean, I understand you enjoy the performing, but do you enjoy, like, when I was younger, you know, when I went to Fort Lauderdale for 2 weeks, it was like, you know, hey, I'm 23, I'm single, you know, there's strippers came to every show, and it's like, woo, You're performing every night. You're like, oh my god, they're giving you free booze and free food. You're like, this is
and
great.
You feel like a rock star.
Yeah,
kinda.
But
yeah.
It's a younger man's game. Now that you're engaged and you're engaged there, do you enjoy the life? Not the performing, but the lifestyle of the road. Do you enjoy like the crappy diner food or stuff like that?
It's different. It's changed for me now. It definitely is harder to get through now. Because also even the performance now, I have a higher expectation for myself. But the bar is higher even when a show doesn't go the way I want it to, or even if the crowd. If I, you know, you never want to blame the crowd. But there's some places you play where you're like, you know what, you guys don't know me, and I don't know you, and we are not. You guys did not want this show that I do, and I don't think anybody YouTube to see what I do. You just came. I do think the experience is different. Now eating the crappy food, staying out late, all that has changed. I feel like I am maturing to the point of now knowing, you know, if there's an 8 o'clock show, I start getting ready at 5 o'clock, and I make it a point to kind of be in the hotel and be in my head and listen to music and not the way I used to be, where I was like, hey, I can do whatever I want. I just got to be at the club at 7:45. I'll be fine. This is great. You know, then it seems like there's nothing on the line. You're just like, I can't believe this is my job. But then I think once you, the deeper you get into it, you then start realizing, well, what do I want to say? And am I happy with what I am saying? Like, now I had my fun and I'm still having fun, but I need to have serious fun. I need to figure out, well, what is my process in growing as an artist? Because I can't just do the same thing I've always been doing. I'll never get anywhere and I'll never accomplish what I want to accomplish. So now the expectation I have on myself has changed. You know, well, you know, I don't stay out late. I don't eat a crappy lunch. I think about these things now going, well, I want to have the best show I can have, because the people that come tonight, I need them coming next year. I need them watching. If I have a thing on TV, I need them wanting to watch it. Or if I have a CD, I want them wanting to buy it. I need them interested in this product that I'm creating. And I think at a certain point, enough times going on the road, it starts to occur to you, this is a product and I should probably start fixing the things that are broken about it.
We have a few minutes left.
Okay,
give everyone your info and where you're coming up and all that stuff. Give it all. Spell it out, because people don't. It's a different spelling. It's
totally. My website is RoryScovel.com.
That's, real quick, what's the 2012? I didn't get to watch it.
I did a video last year where I decided to videotape a little bit of every single day and then cut it into a musical montage. So it's not really anything that's funny. It's just the whole year where I tried to capture. So it's kind of a weird project I gave.
Side.
Yeah, it was my New Year's resolution to make something. So that was the thing I made.
So the info, I'm sorry.
Yep, my website's RoryScovel.com. That's RoryScov, as in Victoria, EL. All my dates and everything is on there. I'm on Twitter. It's at RoryScovel. I think that's probably about it. As far as like shows, the next thing I'm doing is Bloomington, Indiana, early March, next weekend, not this one.
Now, can they find clips on you? Do you have a YouTube channel, or can they find, where can people see your act?
Probably searching just my name on YouTube. I think a bunch of stuff will come up, and I think I do have videos on my site.
So. And how about your CD?
My CD is called Dilation, and that is available on iTunes.
And now, can they get it from your website or just on iTunes?
I think my website will link you to it, and it's also on Amazon.com.
Okay, the actual CD itself.
If you want to get like the hard copy CD, I think you got to do it through Amazon.
That's cool. That's cool. Did you like the cover?
I was obsessed with all the artwork and stuff, so I mulled over the title and everything for a really long time.
Now, you said we have a little time. In a minute. Mm-hmm. Are you writing anything? Are you working on anything? Like you said, you want to write, do movies.
Me and another writer, we sold a show to ABC. In September, so now we're waiting this summer to find out the fate of that show, if ABC wants to shoot the pilot, and also if they want to actually cast me as the guy in the pilot. So that's probably the one thing I'm looking forward to kind of seeing the fate of it. Even if I'm not involved, I'm kind of curious to see how it goes. But
that's cool. Congratulations.
Yeah,
that's
thank
cool.
you. But nothing in the immediate future, just kind of auditioning and trying to think of ideas. You know?
Well, I want to thank you for coming on. I'm glad we could get this scheduled. I'm glad you got back to me on Facebook, because I don't think you go on Facebook a lot. It's so weird.
I'm
you
awful
hate to go through
it.
Facebook, but you go through the websites. But I want to thank you. People, please check out Rory Scovel, RoryScovel.com, and also follow him on Twitter. As for me, people, just, you know, South Jersey people, March 15th, I will be at the Marlton Comedy Cabaret Friday night, me and the legendary Wood, a Philadelphia comedy legend. And so listen every week. Upcoming guests are Dom Irera is coming up in a few weeks. We have Phil Hendry, just a bunch of people. And if you want to hear past episodes, go to www.coopertalk.net. I put up the past weeks every like a week later. Also, go to Stitcher Radio or iTunes, type in Cooper Talk, one word, and you can find my past episodes. Email me at Cooper at indie100.com, INDIE100.com. The fifth person who emails me, the fifth email I get will win a Cooper Talk t-shirt, and I'll even pay the shipping. So there you go. I want emails. I'm a little bitch. Also, Cooper Thought is my blog. I haven't posted lately, but I always try to put up five jokes, cooperthought.com. And listen to Laughcast, LAFFCASTC.com out of Philly. These great guys are making comedy happen. Chris Scamuffa, Nick Cupsey, and all those guys. So listen to that. And I want to thank you for listening. Follow me at Twitter, at Cooper Talk. I'm posting all the time. And yeah, just keep listening. I'm glad you guys could listen. Cooper at Indie100, INDIE100.com. Send me an email. You guys have a wonderful weekend. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. And now time for me to get lunch.